Welcome to episode 72 of Speaking of Mysteries. This is Nancy Clare, and this week Les Klinger and I were joined for lunch at the Napa Valley Grill in Westwood, California by Bonnie McBird, whose Sherlock Holmes adventure, Art in the Blood, was recently published by HarperCollins. Being one of the world's most knowledgeable Sherlockians, Les took the lead in talking to Bonnie about all things great and small in the world of Sherlock Holmes. I was happy to be an eavesdropper to these two experts in what is more akin to a conversation between two old friends than a formal interview. And I think you will be too, whether you are a thoroughly dyed-in-the-wool fan or just a casual visitor to the world of Sherlock Holmes. Here is Bonnie McBird.
You started in England? Is that where the tour started?
Yes, the tour started in London because the book was bought in London by HarperCollins UK.
Seems fair.
Well,
that was the early funding. That was the official funding. It was London.
Yes, the official right. And they moved up the publication a little earlier than it was originally planned because they managed to get me on BBC Breakfast, which is like Good Morning America here, and that shocked the heck out of everybody, including me. And anyway, so they moved it up, and it came out, and it seems to be a hit among the serious British Sherlockians, which I was quaking in my boots about, because, you know, it's the mother load there, right? So
mothership. It's the mothership. Mother load. There's far more Sherlockians
that's
in America
true.
Than in England.
That's true. It's the
we
ship
just
rather
give them,
than...
We give them homage and respect that they don't really deserve.
All right. Well,
don't repeat that to all our mutual friends.
But they do take their Sherlockianness seriously.
They do, but they take it seriously in a slightly different way than we do here.
They're not nutty.
Well, they don't wear hats. They will not wear the hat.
They think we're crazy.
Yes, a little bit. But they're very serious about it in their own way. And they, the launch took place at the Westminster Reference Library.
Nice.
Put on by Catherine Cook, my friend. She's the curator of the Sherlock Holmes collection there. And a longtime member
of the Council of the Sherlock Holmes Society of London.
Yes, and the BSI and lots of things.
She is a BSI also, yes.
Yes, and Roger was there.
Roger Johnson
was there.
Former editor of the Sherlock Holmes Journal.
Yes, and they both loved the book and were very complimentary. And I did. She wanted a lecture, like a talk with slides, so I did that. That was the opening night of the whole thing. And I did a lecture with slides, and there was champagne and stuff like that. And then shortly after that, there was a party at the Sherlock Holmes Hotel, which is where I stay and where I wrote part of the book. It's on Baker Street, overlooking Chipotle. But
and very little Sherlockian stuff in the hotel.
No, there's some nice artwork, but actually I initiated an art contest because it's Art in the Blood. So I had a Sherlockian fan art contest, and there was a purchase award from the hotel, and Jean Upton won it. She did a beautiful Peter Max style Sherlock and Watson painting. It was wonderful. Anyway, so we had an art show, we had a party, the Baker Street Babes were involved in this party, we had drinks that were themed about the book. So, for example, in the book, there's a scene with Toulouse-Lautrec, and in real life, he invented a cocktail called the Earthquake, which is half cognac, half absinthe. We had that drink available. They also created a couple cocktails, the John and the Sherlock, of course. And it was fun. The art contest was fun.
That's good.
Yeah. And my friend Paula Nett, who directed the initial and I think best episodes of the Granada series, was there and had a lot of fun. So it was great fun, and then I did a bunch of other events over there, the Chiswick Book Festival, the Agatha Christie Book Festival. The most interesting thing was a panel with Hugh Fraser, who played Hastings in the Poirot series. So this very Watsonian man was on this panel with me, and he had just written Thriller as a lesbian assassin. And I had just written an adventure as a Victorian gentleman doctor. So the theme of that panel was, what? Why did you do this? So anyway, that was quite fun, actually.
Came over to the States then, and you did a launch at Mysteries Bookshop?
Yes, yes. Otto Penzer was excited about the book and did a wonderful compliment for me about it, and he also made it one of his Mystery Book Club selections. And
did a limited edition.
And he did a limited edition with a foreword by Les Klinger.
Really?
Oh. And not only did you write the introduction, but there's a set of annotations that are Klinger-esque, to use Laurie King's phrase.
Yes. That's one of the things I loved about the book was that you wrote those footnotes, and you were quite serious about your research.
I was serious about the research. That was noted in England. They liked that, too. In fact, universally among the serious Sherlockians, people enjoy that it was the period and all the details were very well researched.
Well, great. Well, we're really thrilled to have you on the show.
Do you think there's an unlimited sort of scope for more Sherlock tales?
Yes. I do. I think Sherlock is evergreen and for very good reason. And also, there's never enough of this stuff, of the good stuff.
That's fortunate since you have a 3-book deal.
It is. It is. And I hope my audience stays with me. And yes, there is a lot of Sherlock out there. There's a lot of bad Sherlock out there. There are a number of really good ones, and I think the people who love Sherlock Holmes love the good ones, but also I think the public loves good Sherlock. And, you know, you don't have to be a Sherlockian to really get into this. It's not like a closed club. Like, you have to know the canon to enjoy this book. You know, I mean, you can just enjoy it coming fresh to it. Leah Cummins Gwynn, who writes the well-read Sherlockian, called my book The Gateway Drug. Because she said, you can read this, you can give this to your friends who know nothing about the canon, and they will love the book. And then if they go, oh, I want to read the real thing, or I want to read the original, they won't be shocked because it's, like, so different. So she said it's the thing you should give your friends and family who don't know Sherlock yet.
Is there anyone left in the world that doesn't know?
That's a good question. I my story about giving a talk on Holmes and having a woman come up to me afterwards and saying, I'm so glad I came. I'm a huge Sherlock Holmes fan. I didn't know there were books.
Right.
I don't know whether you had that experience on your tour already. It's like, wow, this is really good. Has anybody else written about this detective?
Well, I have had people who say they're really only connection is through one of the TV shows.
Sure.
Or maybe the Robert Downey Jr. movies.
Absolutely.
Which you were the technical consultant on, right?
That's absolutely common, yes.
Yeah.
That's very common. That was this woman, and I was so happy to bring her the message that there were actually books written by Arthur Conan Doyle or someone.
And Otto made that point once when I was talking to him, Otto Penzler, that after the Sherlock, the BBC series came out, he probably sold more Sherlock Holmes books in a month than he had in the previous 10
years. Sales of the original canon rose. So this is good.
Well, one of the cool things that I love about BBC Sherlock is that it was written by people who love the canon, and that love and respect and affection is present in the show, and to my mind.
I think that's true of all three of the series that are going on right now. They all have a great affection for the original material. They've made different things of it, but Robert Downey was quick to say, you know, why would we make up stuff?
Right.
And go back to the original.
The original is so good. Exactly. And, I thought his performance was very, very true to the canon, and he's one of my favorite Sherlocks.
So, you're a recently outed Sherlock.
Or previously closeted.
Yes, that is exactly right, yes.
But you have a long career behind you as a writer.
Yes.
This is your first book, however?
This is my first published book. I did do a mystery kind of thriller novel that didn't get published about 10 years ago. And there was a Sherlockian element to it in that it was a female private eye set in Boston. And her cop contact was a Sherlockian. So there was that. But this is my first novel to be published. And
but you've been screenwriting for a long time.
Yes, many years.
And you teach screenwriting.
I do. I teach at UCLA Extension.
So how was this a different experience for you? And, did you like it compared to what else, the other stuff? Was this better? Or, I mean, it's just something else.
It's creatively, it's different in a lot of ways, and sort of from a psychological business and other sense, it's different.
Creatively, you won't make any money because you're a writer.
Yeah, yes, exactly. Books aren't going to make the kind of money that a screenplay makes, but the creative freedom and the sort of the control you have as the writer is a completely different story when you're writing a book, and it's a pleasure. I love working collaboratively. I work in theater even now quite a bit, but I also love the notion of having a vision about something and then my vision getting out there. I mean, that is such a huge pleasure. Now, on the other hand, I also like writing in first person. I like writing in a voice because screenwriting, you have to write, you're separate from the story and you have to only write what you see and hear on the screen. So you're very constrained in that way. Also, you're constrained by the fact that screenwriting is almost like haiku. It's so spare. You can't use very many words, basically. And this, on the other hand, you have a point of view going through. You have Watson, so you're talking in Watson's voice. You have a point of view. You can imbue it with opinion and humor and stuff that isn't quite the same when you're writing a screenplay. So there's so many reasons that it was, you know, artistically a really fun adventure for me to do. And then I've augmented it, you know, because I'm, like, as you said, I was a closeted Sherlockian and now I'm come out. I sort of don't do anything halfway, so now I'm also doing some plays and stuff, and I've been working with actors, and I love seeing some of the work I'm doing coming, you know, being performed. So that's hugely fun, hugely.
My wish for you, Bonnie, is that you continue to have the joy of writing. I mean, this is because I've had too many friends who have loved the writing part and hated what came after that, which is the marketing, the having to be out on tour, having to promote the book constantly. And HarperCollins is a great publisher, but, you know, obviously you're one of the hundreds of their catalog, and if it's going to be a success, it's going to be because you make it a success. You're doing a lot, and it's easy to burn out. So I wish you good cheer about that, I guess.
I'm only a few weeks into doing this for the first time, but I don't mind the performance aspects of it, but it is, what's terrifying as an artist is, you know, put the work out there and, you know, you're judged, right? So, you know, every person with a pseudonym and a grudge can snipe at you. And this is an interesting phenomenon of our modern times now and of the internet. So, you know, I have to, basically as an artist, it's like you have to kind of figure out what it is you're trying to do and just try to achieve that. And you have to be careful about whether you later, you know, analyze that. Did I achieve my goal? And what was my goal? So for example, I think when you're writing a pastiche, Sherlock Holmes pastiche, there's so many different approaches you can take. You can say, one of the first things I remember, Les, with you was we went out to lunch very early in this process, but I didn't really know you very well at all. And I said, what are your pet peeves with pastiches? And you gave me some really funny ones. One of them was like, I hate it when they talk too much about food. I remember this one specifically. And then so before I sat down to write mine, I thought, like, what are my pet peeves and what do I love? You know, which ones do I love and what, and also, of course, what do I love about canon? What am I trying to emulate here? And so I actually had a list, you know, about that. And and it's specific to me, so it's not everybody else's list, you know, and everybody else isn't going to agree with me on this. But I personally, for example, I don't want to see recycled deductions. I want them to be all new, because that's one of the cool things, and I want them to be fresh, and they're really hard to do, as Stephen Moffat said, you know, they're really hard to do. So you need to do that work. That's one of my things. The other is that it better be funny, because Canon was hilariously funny, and if you miss that, like, forget about it. And another one is that it really needs to root in the friendship, because that's, you know, one of the key attractions. I mean, in addition to the, you know, the character and the brilliance and the, and, you know, the cozy Victorian era, and I mean all the things that people talk about a million times, there's these other things. And somebody asked me, like, why Sherlock Holmes? And I realized that I love smart people. I want to be with smart people. If I am the smartest person in the room, I am bored. And I really want, I like to be around intelligent people. And, you know, that's the way it is.
One of the things that always annoys me about pastiche writing, or much pastiche writing, is the language, is that people don't pay attention to the language. They basically write modern English, modern American, as opposed to thinking about what they would have said. I'm not a pastiche writer, as you know. I mean, I've written one story in my life.
It's quite good, though.
Yeah, thank you. But I actually did an interesting exercise in writing letters. So I don't know that you've read them. I found, as all pastiche writers did, I found a series of letters between Dr. Watson and Arthur Conan Doyle. And they are fascinating because they are over a long period of time, from basically the very early days of their meeting, which is probably around 1879, maybe around there, before he met Holmes, and through the date of Conan Doyle's death. And one of the things I decided in writing those letters was that Watson, as a writer who used lots of phrases and similes and metaphors and all that, you know, sort of once you think of something that you think you're saying in a clever way, you use it in other contexts, too. So in these letters to Conan Doyle, and there are a lot of things that will sound sort of canonical, they're totally out of context because they're not about Sherlock Holmes. These are letters about their lives and what's going on, and it was interesting to do that. It was difficult. Now you did a different process, but you were very meticulous about your language. You want to tell us a little about that in between bites?
Well, yeah, the language is really interesting to me. I paid a lot of attention to it, but I did it in a certain way. So I did it kind of, if you wanted to separate it into right brain and left brain approaches. The right brain is an oversimplification because they now don't follow those descriptions quite so rigidly. But the right brain approach was kind of reading aloud, as an actor does when they're trying to learn their lines, and sort of getting it in my body, the rhythm and the feel, and how he speaks and how he uses metaphor, how he uses the, you know, all of the writing devices, how and when he uses them. He used a lot more dialogue, for example, in his work than other contemporary writers. He also didn't wax, he waxed poetic, but very, very briefly, because he was more about narrative drive. There's a certain, you know, but I'm slipping into the left brain already. But what I was saying is I started by reading them out loud, and I started every morning's writing with reading a little bit out loud. And then I would just start writing without judgment, trying to basically imitate the voice. It's like almost like an accent or a dialect, but really focusing on the story. But then sort of as a secondary thing, I did a whole bunch of levels. And one of the things that was, I kept the Canon open on my desktop, on the computer desktop, open as a single file, which is a searchable file. So when I was in doubt whether a word was modern or not, I would search for it in Canon. And if I couldn't find it, I would then check to see the origin of the word and the usage of the word in some other places. And if it really wasn't used frequently at that time, I would replace it. But then I did another level, which was, this is in addition to the other editorial input I got from people, but I toward the end of the whole process, I hired a woman who, I got her on Elance, who lived up in the Highlands of Scotland, and she was a former Oxford University press editor, and I tried her out on two chapters, and she thrilled me. So I hired her to detail the book out, make sure I had no Americanisms at all in there. And not only did she do this beautifully, and there weren't too many by that point, by the way, but there were a few, and she got them. And then she also said to me, you know, you have him crossing in the wrong place in Waterloo Place. And she says, I happen to know that because my husband's a member of the Reform Club. And at that point, I knew I'd hired the right person.
It's hard to do that. Listen, with the annotated, I was constantly in fear that I was either getting something wrong that would be obvious to an English person, or missing something that some English person reading it would say, well, you idiot, that's what this means, and, you know.
Right.
Because it's just out of context. So I think you did a lovely job on the language of the book. And it is hard. It's, reading aloud, I think, is a terrific way to do it. And you also did a lot of research on sort of the other material. And
that's fun.
Shouldn't be as important as it is. It is fun. It is. Unfortunately, in the mystery community, maybe it's not unfortunate, but in the mystery community, it's just something that we live with. And of course, that would be the way that Sherlockians behave all the time.
Yeah, yeah, about everything. Yeah. Well, actually, Roger Johnson did call me on a train timetable issue. So he is now on my list to be consulted for the train travel on my next book.
Absolutely. And it isn't just Sherlockians. Many, many mystery writers. You know, they're so nervous that everybody's going to, their readers are going to call them up and say, you have to turn right at the stop sign on Maple and Elm. Don't you know it's a left turn only?
Yeah.
You know?
Right, exactly.
Everybody knows that.
But the historical ones especially, I feel like whenever I read something set in another time period, I want to feel that I'm in the hands of somebody who cares so that I can relax and just enjoy the story.
Yes.
So if something giant sticks out at me, it interrupts my enjoyment of the story. You know, I want to feel like I'm really transported.
So you were forced to go to Paris.
I was forced, yes.
A good deal of the book takes place in Paris.
Yes.
And does that reflect a long time relationship between you and Paris?
It does. It does. My first husband was French, in fact. So, I've been to Paris a lot. I've been very lucky that way. And I also love the Impressionist art movement, and there was a lot of really exciting stuff going on in Paris in 1888 when this book is set. So I set actually a whole sequence at the Chat Noir, and I went to the site of where it was in 1888, and of course now it's a seedy bar, but there's an area behind it. It was kind of a patio area behind it where I set a fight scene, and I actually went to that place. And this is something that some pastiche writers don't like, but it wasn't on my list, and that is I stuck a couple of real people in there into the story. One is Toulouse-Lautrec, and he's only in there very briefly, but the client, who's a French singer, takes refuge. They all take refuge in his apartment at a certain moment. And that's where I found my favorite research moment, was researching Lautrec. Because I was looking for various examples of his paintings to include in the annotations as, you know, very representative of him. And I found this very handsome kind of man, blonde man with a mustache and a top hat, standing in the doorway of his Lautrec's atelier. And his name was Dr. Henri Bourges. And it turns out this man was his childhood friend of Lautrec and lived with him on and off throughout the man's entire life, except for the time when Bourges was married briefly. And his whole function was to sort of, he partied with Lautrec, because Lautrec had a lot of fun, but he also was trying to keep his friend from his addictions. And I thought,
he was Lautrec's
watcher.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a real life person. And there's a photograph of him, which I include in the annotations. They run through the streets of Paris from the Chat Noir to Lautrec's apartment, and I have the address of that. So I actually ran that and noticed where the hills were and what was there, and looked them up in antique maps and see the street change names.
Research is hell, isn't it?
Yeah. I know, and it's like tough. But anyways, it was very fun. And I went up and visited a silk mill in the north of England. And they have a Victorian silk mill that still exists and it's all workable. And you can take a tour of that. So I set a scene in there, and that was a lot of fun.
So I wanted to talk to you about there's a character named Vidocq. How did he get to be named Vidocq? I've forgotten. Did you create a relationship with the real Vidocq? I don't remember now.
No. He is a kind of slightly con man detective character. And he's fairly successful, but he's a questionable person. And he named himself that and claims to be a great-grandson of.
Yes.
But as Holmes points out to Watson, there are no known descendants of Vidocq. So he's probably concocted that. And it would be very in keeping with his character if he had. So, no, he's not Vidocq. I have had a couple of reviewers say, oh, Vidocq, that's the wrong era. Or like, it's like, no, you didn't read the detail.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's because they didn't have time to actually read the book.
Actually, probably not.
I'm wondering, though, and I thought a lot about Vidocq, if he's going to show up in any of your subsequent books, because he looks like that kind of bad penny.
Yeah, he's fun, and he's, yes, actually, he's already walked onto the pages in book two.
Are you going back to France for book two?
Yes, briefly, in a different part of France, though, because the one of the subject matters of book two, which is called Unquiet Spirits, is the phylloxera epidemic in the vineyards, and so
the fraudeurs, the French. Crooks who basically leapt into. Are they in there? I wrote my very first article about Sherlock Holmes ever was about. I imagine. I said. So, I'm sorry. James Windebank is the villain in a story called The Case of Identity. And he does something bad, but it isn't like the terrible thing. He does something bad. He basically defrauds his stepdaughter out of her money. By pretending to be her lover, disguises himself as her lover, and woos her and then vanishes on her wedding night because he wants her to stay home. He wants her to be so heartbroken that she'll never marry, she'll stay home, and he'll control her trust fund. Well, Holmes jumps all over him like he is the worst villain ever, and he works for Marv Bank and... I've forgotten the name of the firm, Marbank and somebody, wine importers. And I thought to myself, why is Holmes so down on this guy when he did this bad thing, but he isn't like, you know, his first
like a murderer,
crime.
Yeah.
And it's his first crime. Right. And it's sort of, you know, it's not like a murderer. And he does, you know, he does a heartless thing, but it's not, he's just using the money for his household and all that. So I said, I think he's also, that Holmes knows that he's also one of the fraudeurs, that he's involved with the scheme. Because what was happening was the phylloxera epidemic so devastated the Bordeaux crops, the English appetite for Bordeaux did not diminish. And so the winemakers in France were making wine out of anything. I mean, raisins, they would press raisins and make wine. It was terrible wine, but they'd put honest labels on it. They'd put, you know, Chateau Margaux labels on it and sell fraudulent wine.
And other countries were doing all kinds of fraudulent activity was going on, but...
The fraudeurs, I don't know if my French is that good, I don't pronounce it right. So that's what the book is going to be about, sort of?
Well, not exactly,
in
but...
In a sense, well, now you have to read my article, so...
Yes, I do have to read your article. It might become
James
more about
James Windebank,
that.
The underestimated villain.
Ah, oh, right, okay. Hosmer Angel, right? Wasn't that his
Hosmer Angel
pseudonym?
Was his pseudonym, yes.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Yeah, I remember that. I like that story.
So, the second book is well underway.
Yep.
When will it come out?
Not sure exactly.
Are you supposed to deliver it? That's more important.
Well, it's summer next year.
Oh, my.
Summer next year. And, you know, it's interesting. It's a challenge. Originally, it was going to be a little earlier, but, you know, I don't know how people do historical novels in a year, because to me, the research is another whole pass, really. And you know, I do some of it before, some of it during, and then I do a lot after as well, because I really want to make sure, as you just said, you know, Nancy, that it isn't wrong. Yeah, that something is not wrong. So I just, you know.
So what I wanted to ask was, where do you see this going for yourself? I mean, are you going to see yourself as strictly a Sherlockian writer, or are you going to, you've already got ideas about other things now that you want to do now that you've discovered loving writing books?
I do love writing books. That's a good question. I think I'm so frankly taken in and up, not taken in, that's not the right word. I'm so in love, basically, with Sherlock Holmes, that I can see myself doing this for a while.
You're swept away.
That sounds good.
It worked for June Thompson,
But I also get bored easily, so, you know, I've changed careers about 6 times, so I think, you know, I wrote this novel about 10 years ago with Female Private Eye, and, you know, it's one of those ones where it's calling me to come back and revise it, so I'm thinking I might enjoy having more than one series, I think.
Next week, we'll be talking to debut novelist J.S. Law about Tenacity, his tense thriller about a murder investigation that takes place in the claustrophobic world of a British naval submarine. Until then, this is Nancy Clare. Thank you again for listening to Speaking of Mysteries.